I'm David Lazarus, and this is the Marketplace Weekend Podcast for the weekend of June 12th, 2015.
I'm sailing away, set an open course for the virgin sea.
Migration can mean new beginnings, new adventures, new lands. It's setting your sights on the horizon and finding your place in the world. And it doesn't hurt to have a little Styx playing in the background while you get there. I'm David Lazarus from the LA Times, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with real life. Lizzie O'Leary will be back next week, but in the meantime, come sail away with me as we talk about migration. Migrating your data, migrating creatures, migrating for a job. And speaking of which, have you done that recently? Moved somewhere for a new place to work? So what was it like? How did it change you? How did it change your finances? Let us know by visiting MarketplaceWeekend.org or Marketplace's Facebook page. Or, of course, you can tweet us. We're at MarketplaceWKND. Let's unfurl our sails and start the show with workers migrating from abroad to Silicon Valley. H-1B visas allow skilled workers to come to the U.S., and they're being heavily employed by the tech industry. In fact, Disney attracted attention when it laid off about 250 tech workers and had them train their foreign replacements. Ouch! Big tech companies claim that the U.S. can't meet their needs when it comes to programming and engineering jobs, and they want to expand the H-1B program. All right, to find out more about these visas, we're joined by Dan Siciliano. He's an immigration policy expert at Stanford Law School. Dan, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here.
So let's start with this Disney thing. Is this unusual that a big company would ask their domestic workers to train their foreign replacements?
I think it is pretty unusual. In the bigger picture of the use of temporary visas, particularly H-1B visas in the United States, the pattern and the typical story is not of bringing people in and moving, you know, U.S. workers away from their desks and putting foreign workers in that place. And in fact, even with the Disney story, I think it's hard to sort out what the underlying real facts are, and I think we'll eventually know, but it looks like it's pretty complicated. And among, you know, some of the interesting points are that the folks that they brought in appear to be somewhat more technical, and Disney's trying to enhance their innovation, so they reworked their mix of employees. But the bottom line is that this isn't the typical H-1B story. I think it kind of plays badly, and it certainly on its face sounds a little scary, frankly. I hope the H-1B program isn't used in that way, and I think the evidence points that it's not. But, you know, it's a good reason to talk about H-1Bs, which I think are a bigger picture issue for the United States economy and are pretty important.
All right, very quickly, H-1B 101. Let's talk about what are they and why are they controversial?
Since 1990, Congress has created a category that allows a limited number of foreign workers to come to the United States. Right now, the statutory cap is $65,000 a year, and there's an extra $20,000 allowed for people who are educated in the United States with a master's or a doctorate, but they're from outside the United States. In recent years, we use those up instantly. We have a huge demand for them. The category is meant for individuals who have a bachelor's or better in a specialty occupation, which typically means a STEM occupation. So it's science, technology, engineering, or mathematics. So it's a pretty targeted visa. It's meant to be used only for 3 years, and it's got a max of three more years, so it's for 6 years. It is temporary. And from a big picture viewpoint, by the way, from like total labor turnover in the United States, right now, as of about a week ago, there's a little more than 5.3 million open positions in the United States. So the 65,000 visas is actually a pretty small number, but the type of skills those people bring to the United States are really important.
And these are good jobs. These are high-paying Silicon Valley jobs, which in theory are going to set you up for a lot of upward mobility. So they're much in demand. And I'm always hearing from Silicon Valley that, oh, we would love to be hiring American workers, but they lack the skills, they lack the education, they're just not qualified. Is that true?
it is true, but it's complicated. So the short answer is that for U.S.-born workers with science, technology, engineering, and mathematics skills at the bachelor's plus level or the master's, there aren't enough. In fact, if you look at unemployment rates, even prior to the recession, during the recession, after the recession, the numbers are really low for STEM degree holders in the United States, whether they're immigrant or non-immigrant. I'm talking, 3%, 2%, in some categories, 0.1% unemployment rate for these types of employees. So it is true. We don't have enough. But these are really important jobs. They're good jobs, too. The other side of this, at least certainly the story in Silicon Valley, I teach the venture capital classes here, and a lot of the times I'm looking at these teams and I say, you know what you need to do? You need to go find a technical team member. Go find someone who's an engineer. That's always the missing component of these teams. And so these H-1B, visa recipients tend to be very complementary. They enable the economy because, the teams that can't find someone who's technically oriented, they never launch. The teams that do, they launch and they grow. And then you end up with these companies that create hundreds, if not thousands of jobs. So it's kind of an enabling story, particularly in the West Coast right now in the technology sector.
How have the U.S. public and private sectors responded to this shortcoming in our preparing younger generations for these high quality jobs? Is there an effort underway to try and fill that hole and thus ease our need for these overseas workers?
I think the answer is yes, but realize the U.S. economy is a giant tanker in the ocean. It is very hard to turn. In fact, it's very hard to even just nudge it in one direction or the other. And when it comes to training people, it takes a generation. So I think there is a lot of focus. And one of the outcomes of the H-1B program, when you get an H-1B, if you're the employer sponsoring it, you pay an extra fee that goes into a technology training fund that is used to augment U.S. training of U.S.-born workers in these fields. And that's been around for a while, but it's really only now starting to show up. So I do think there's a new emphasis on technology and engineering mathematics training. And I actually think the most important thing is if you look at television, movies, popular culture, it has become sexy again, or maybe I'm fooling myself, but I think it's become sexy again to be a little bit nerdy, a little bit technical, a little bit mathy. That'll make the big difference, right? Because there are these great jobs. You can have a wonderful life and be very well paid. And if you're a 14-year-old deciding whether or not you want to take advanced algebra in high school because it's a hard class, hopefully that makes the difference.
Yeah, well, I can say at the same time, my kid, he's 13, he's going to be taking Java programming this summer at camp.
Yay.
And he's coming in with an algebra background. This is our future.
That's a very positive story. And if we can keep him on track and his friends, then I think we turn this story around. Because, by the way, we need the H-1Bs. Without them, jobs and companies go outside the United States. That shortfall is a disaster for our economy. But even when we bring people in the United States, they do contribute to the economy, but it's costly for the companies to do that. I haven't found a company yet who would prefer an H-1B over a qualified U.S.-born worker. Despite all the kind of news, everyone would rather hire someone from here who they know, is going to stay here and has all these roots here. It just makes it a lot easier to grow talent. So that's a great story. So he should send in his resumes now. I think Silicon Valley isn't shy about hiring people who are very young.
Yeah, Papa needs a new pair of shoes. Dan Siciliano is a professor at Stanford Law School. He specializes in immigration policy. Dan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Last week, we asked you to write into our website, marketplaceweekend.org, and tell us your stories about moving for work. Well, we had a lot of great responses, including one from Linda Oakleaf. She's a professor, and for her and many other academics, that often means a life of migration, going where the academic action is. Linda and her family currently live in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. However,
well, right now that's where I live and work. I actually won't be living here for very much longer. At the end of July, we're moving to Missouri. So my wife Becky and I and our twins, we have 2-year-old twins, and so moving's a lot more complicated when you have toddlers. Even putting things in boxes takes more time than it used to take. But we're all picking up sticks. It's actually kind of a bummer. The kids are just now, like when we pull in the driveway now, Abby goes home. And I keep thinking, oh, well, for a little while, don't get don't get too attached because we're about to move. When I started this adventure, I knew that the deal was that if you're an academic, you move. And I knew that a lot of folks didn't end up settling in the, even in their first tenure track job, that a lot of folks will, because that first tenure track job isn't always ideal, that will pick up and move. It's what I want to do with my life. And you spend a third of your life at work or more. And so if you get the chance to do what you love, that's a significant portion of the time you spend breathing. So it was important enough for me to make the sacrifices. I do have to say, as my kids get older, I'm less enthralled with the idea of moving. We look at cost of living. Good grief, I've spent so much time on the internet. One of my favorite tricks is to jump on Google Maps and, like, literally wander around the neighborhood with street view, trying to be like, what would it be like if I were walking down this street around this potential house I'm looking at? Just because, you know, I mean, it is nice that there's more information out there than there would have been. But, you know, the magic of the internet can only do so much. For one thing, if we had ended up in Maine, I would have been married there, and that would have been really nice. I haven't actually lived. We've been married. We got married. The license that we have that's good was 2008, although we got married the first time in 2004. We've never since then lived somewhere where we were actually married. So it would have been really nice for that to happen. I've still never been to Kansas City. Until I go get a house at the beginning of July, I won't have even seen the place. But it's got a Hamburger's Mary's, so I'm hoping that that means it's going to be okay. I mean, it's a ridiculous way to choose a place to live, but I'm not even kidding. That's, we're like, well, let's go to the neighborhood with the Hamburger Mary's in it. It's got to be okay there.
We'll hear more about what you had to say and dig a little deeper on migrating for work later in the show. We're focused on migration in today's show. Before we get back to that, let's look at some of the biggest numbers in the news this week. Every day, Marketplace's By the Numbers blog tracks those figures and serves them up at marketplace.org. Here's digital producer Tony Wagner with this week's rundown. Tony?
Thanks, David. Our first number is
1,012.
The Wall Street Journal says that's how many nutrition and snack bars are on the market right now. 10 years ago, there were just 226, and they cost half as much. The snack bar business is high margin and growing quickly, combining convenience with nutrition, or at least the appearance of nutrition.
$3.6 billion
is the total amount of debt held by students who attended Corinthian colleges. The for-profit chain recently shut down, and it's the subject of a federal probe. The government announced it's going to forgive that debt. The move comes at a high cost to taxpayers, and it's stoking conversation about the government's role in doing out student loans in the first place.
$80,162.
That's how much more the average millennial working in San Jose, California, would have to make in a year to afford a typical mortgage there. That's according to a new analysis from Bloomberg. It's the largest gap in the country between pay for young people and home prices. Side note, I just moved to LA from Minneapolis, and there, millennials make $12,000 more on average than they would need for a mortgage.
Let's get back to migration now and talk about migratory habits. Not the ones like birds and bears or our senior producer's hairline, but that of investors. Yeah, investors migrate, or their dollars do. And that's what money managers are for, to move money around and make the best return possible. And usually that's a good thing. Money flows to the most profitable investments. But sometimes that movement can be disruptive and roil the markets that connect to our economic lives and our 401ks. To talk about the migration of money, I'm joined by our resident explainer and host of Marketplace's Whiteboard, Patty Hirsch. Hiya, Patty.
Hello, David.
Now, I've been watching some movement this week in the bond and stock market, and I'm not quite sure what's going on there.
Well, we're seeing this migration, if you like, out of bonds, right? So people are selling government bonds, and the reason they're doing that is because they are more confident about the economy. So they're selling bonds and they're putting money into stocks because they're more confident about the fact that the stock market is rising and will continue to rise as opposed to correct and fall back down. Now, they may be right or wrong about that, but there's definitely a move from bonds into stocks.
And oftentimes when we see that, as you say, it speaks to a confidence because stocks grow quicker than bonds, and bonds are sort of a safe harbor when storm clouds are over there. All right, so if I'm sitting there worrying about my 401k or my petty little investments, am I thinking, I want to get a piece of this?
Well, you might want to get a piece of this, in which case you're in good shape because your stocks are probably rising right now. The problem is, of course, that when you have large amounts of money sloshing from one part of the economy to another, there's a danger, of course, that it's going to slosh back again. So once we start to see bonds rise, and we are going to see bond interest rates rise because there's no doubt that the Federal Reserve at some point is going to increase interest rates, it means then that there is another area of the economy that's going to start paying a yield. So investors who are in the stock market will inevitably move some of that money out of the stock market. And when that happens, we will have a stock market correction. So if you're worried about day-to-day movements in the stock market, you are going to have a bit of a heart attack at that point.
But interestingly, you're describing a dynamic that does not reflect the actual value of what these equities represent. For example, if people are piling into the stock market, it should represent great value, great growth, you know, all these positives. But really what it sounds like is, no, it's a good time to get out of bonds.
Well, okay, so there are three things that are driving the stock market right now, right? Firstly, there are people who are in there because they actually see a real value in those companies, you know, and they're investing in the company very specifically. The second type of person are the people who are, they're like the surfers. They like to ride the wave, right? They're getting into those stocks. They're getting into the market because the market is rising. They don't care about what's in it. They just care about the fact that it's going up and they want to sell out whenever it falls away. Then the third type are these people who look around the rest of the world and say, there's nothing else to invest in that's got any yields, right? Bonds are at really, really low yields. I'm not making any money there. Real estate's still bumbling along, not making much money there. Commodities markets look pretty rubbish, so we're not going to make any money there. Stocks are the only game in town. So they're in it because it's the only place they can actually make money. So whenever there is a place you can make money, those people are going to jump out, right? So they're going to be gone. And then the wave riders, they're going to jump off because the wave's not riding anymore. And you are going to see this correction. There's no doubt that stocks will fall. They're not going to go a hugely long way, but they will correct. And that will be a bit of a heart murmur moment for people, although they shouldn't sell out.
No, and in fact, a lot of the experts are saying that the market is due for a correction, mm-hmm. and it'll probably be very healthy.
Yep.
But in terms of money moving from one part of the portfolio to another, that's one part of the equation. But what about money that actually wants to jump geographic barriers?
Oh, yeah, that happens a lot these days, right? You've got a lot of hedge funds and private equity funds that have got a lot of money, and all they want to do is to make more money. And they don't care where they make it. They can make it in the U.S., in the equity markets. They can make it in China, in the property markets. They can make it in the Vietnamese stock market. And that money, they call it hot money, right? Because it moves around real quick. It will go from place to place as in the blink of an eye, and it can have a really distortive effect on those markets.
So when this hot money is out there pursuing hot profits, hot investments, that's not anything like a long-term investment or a reflection of long-term potential.
No, it's a reflection of which market happens to be going up at any one time. What market is hot? That attracts the hot money. And of course, the problem is that, you know, say the Chinese construction market, right? So everybody dives, all this hedge fund money goes into the Chinese property market. It inflates property prices in an incredible way because everybody's now got to compete with the hedge funds. And then the Vietnamese stock market takes off. So all that hedge fund money flows out of Chinese construction. What happens? The property prices just go thumping down. And all of those local investors in China, suddenly they find that they are really out of luck.
How fast does this happen? Could hot money begin the morning in the U.S., spend lunchtime in China, and end the day in India?
I suppose theoretically it could. I mean, the way that the financial markets work these days, money can move incredibly fast, like click of a mouse fast.
All right, now, that raises different issues for the small investor, because if you've got the hedge funds and the quants and all those guys out there who are dealing in light speed, mm-hmm. actually moving hot money around willy-nilly, I'm sitting here doing my homework, I'm crunching numbers, I'm looking at good investments, and you're telling me that the marketplace is completely distorted.
Well, it's not completely distorted in a mature market like ours. And this is why hot money is such a big deal in places like Asia or, you know, the emerging markets in Eastern Europe. You know, it's because those markets are not completely developed. People don't really understand necessarily how industries are working. So there's a lot more sort of, you know, areas around the edges, a lot more uncertainty, a lot more risk to deal with. So, you know, people like you and I aren't going to be looking at those markets as long-term investments, right? We're not going to be saying, oh, yes, let's get involved in the Shanghai property market today. I mean, it's like, it's impenetrable to us, so we shouldn't even be thinking about that. That's a place where these sophisticated investors who are prepared to lose all of their money, if necessary, are going to be playing, and we don't want to be getting our feet wet in that.
So that S&P 500 index fund looking better and better every day.
Every day.
Patty Hirsch is our resident explainer and host of our online explainer series, The Marketplace Whiteboard. Patty, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, David.
Now from where migration meets money to where it meets your data, when you and I interact with the world of tech.
Today, we're going to be showing our friends the basics of technology. This is Tech in Real Life.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. And we're talking migration, of course, and your data likes to go from place to place, perhaps even more than you can imagine. Ben, let's talk about data migration and the fine art of getting ones and zeros from one place to another.
Is it a fine art? I don't know. It feels like a brutal art. It is something that we're having to do more and more now, as you know. Holding on to data can be complicated and sometimes expensive. Migrating that data, it feels like clutter in the real world, right? It's all over the place. Your filing system maybe hasn't been consistent. It's actually harder in some ways because it's less visible, right? If your house is a mess, David, you got to care and clean it up. And your old computer files hidden somewhere, unless they're actually on your desktop, the guilt is harder to feel. You can store things on hardware, like your phone or your computer, or on an external hard drive, or you can store things in the cloud, David, as we know, either for free or with a paid service. Some services are free until you hit a kind of certain digital clutter ceiling, and then you got to pay. Migrating data is an interesting idea because as companies change and disappear, as technical standards in the physical world evolve, old hard drives and cords don't maybe connect to new computers, new phones, you have to adapt.
It sounds like what we're talking about is one storage facility online might either become defunct or full, and then you've got to worry about it. Here's an example. My wife and I store our photos online, which is a miracle to me, and yet the service that we once used, which I won't name, Kodak, isn't around anymore, and suddenly we have to find some other place to put it. And now I look the other day, and Google has some kind of photo service, but it seems like my photos just keep wandering around the ether.
Yeah, this is a real problem for people as our digital world ages and as we age in that digital world. You know, Google, as you hinted at, has this new service. It'll store unlimited photos. But as you know, David, free data storage comes with a price, right? And we don't know necessarily what Google might be doing with our photos. Well, maybe we have some idea of what the company might do with our photos now, but 10, 15, 20 years from now, you know, it's hard to tell. There are trade-offs no matter what. Your hard drive could crash, for instance. Your house could burn down, and along with it, your photo collection. Your device could be stolen. So whether we're talking physical world, digital world, there are, you know, things you have to watch out for or think about. People who really care about their data, really care about it, and are really engaged with this, usually have backups in the physical world and in the digital world. And in the digital world, they can spend, you know, several thousand dollars sometimes on setting up and maintaining a robust personal cloud.
Is it possible for my data to get out there and then just go missing?
Definitely. I was looking for something the other day, actually, you know, old photos that I had posted to MySpace. And because MySpace has gone through a bunch of changes, I couldn't find them. That doesn't necessarily mean that they've disappeared. They're probably somewhere. And I found some parts of the information I had originally put on MySpace out there and down the internet rabbit hole. You know, a lot of this stuff can change and can effectively for us disappear, at least disappear from our eyes as we're searching around the internet.
So where is this all going? Is there going to be cheaper, faster, safer ways to get our data from point A to point B?
We can hope. We can cross our fingers and hope. Services like Spotify, Google Photo, and Apple's Photo Stream are pretty good at seamlessly integrating your storage, and it seems like we're headed more towards that in some ways. Sometimes these companies will help you move your data around without really even thinking about it. You're probably familiar with, you know, setting something up like Facebook or the Twitter app on your phone and having it take a look at all your contacts and helping you connect with those people in that social service. There was an interesting example the other day. I went to Apple's Worldwide Developers Conference where the company released some news that it was building an actual app for its new operating system, iOS 9, that helps users who are jumping from Android phones to an iOS phone migrate a ton of their data. It'll suggest apps on iOS that are the same or similar to what you had on your Android phone. It'll move your contacts, your messages, calendars, mail accounts, things like that, even manage your photos for you. So companies are thinking a lot about this as our world evolves and ages, our digital world, and we should be thinking about it too.
Boy, time to migrate my data out of here. Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and is stored in the cloud. Ben, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, David.
They're called Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals and Deferred Action for Parents of Americans, DACA and DAPA for short. What we're really talking about here, though, are millions of people whose lives and their livelihoods have been put on hold as lawyers wrangle over U.S. immigration policy. In November, President Obama announced an executive order that would shield about 5 million people from deportation. That move has been challenged in court, and the programs are in limbo. So what happens now to all those who would have been assisted by these programs? Andres Lemons, an attorney with the City University of New York's Immigration Now program, explains.
Deferred action was going to help millions of people, and we were really excited about it. But unfortunately, there was a lawsuit filed in Texas and supported by 25 other states. And so the judge there issued an injunction putting the program on hold. And it's still on hold. The courts are fighting it, but I'm confident that the program is going to be allowed to go through.
Is the government aware of who these people are and where they can be found? Do they risk imminent deportation?
I mean, there are millions and millions of undocumented immigrants in the country. I don't think the government knows where most of them are, but this is a way for immigrants to square things and get right with everything. You know, they have to pass some background checks. They have to pay a fee, and it's an opportunity for them to get right with the law.
And the millions of undocumented workers in this country clearly have a profound effect on the economy. Isn't there nothing but economic gain from legalizing their status?
When these people have their cases approved, they are allowed to apply for a Social Security card, which means they can start working with that card and file taxes. So there's a huge economic benefit for the Social Security Administration. It would also create jobs. You know, a lot of these people would be able to start businesses and employ other workers. There's a lot of benefits economically.
But critics say, first of all, that these people jumped the queue, essentially, and didn't follow the correct procedures to come into the country legally. Moreover, they might be taking jobs from U.S. citizens. How valid is that criticism?
Basically, you know, there's no way that the government could deport the estimated 11 million immigrants. It would take years, if not, you know, decades, cost billions of dollars. It's just impossible logistically and financially. So, you know, something has to be done. We can't just have the status quo. So this is a way to get the process rolling because Congress has been unable to fix the system.
It sounds like these programs are logistically complicated and probably require a great deal of federal resources. How are they funded?
Deferred action is funded by immigrants paying the fees. So basically when they apply, they pay a fee the government doesn't really pay anything. It's all based on fees.
So taxpayers don't have to worry that this is money out of their pockets.
about 90% of USCIS's budget, USCIS is the agency that grants these benefits, is based on fees paid by immigrants.
Do you think immigration is going to be a paramount issue in the upcoming presidential election?
Yeah, definitely. It was an issue last election, but I think it's going to be bigger this year. There's more support for it. It's been on people's minds lately with Obama's administrative action. And there's definitely going to be a lot of controversy. I think there are a lot of misunderstandings about what immigration reform means. So part of it will be just kind of clarifying, you know, what it means to the public.
Andras Lemons is an attorney at City University of New York's Citizenship Now program. Andras, thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks a lot.
We're talking about migration in today's show, and we learned this week that about 2.7 million people quit their jobs in April to look for greener pastures elsewhere. And that's a very good sign for the economy. What it means is people are feeling upbeat about their chances. But it also suggests that many people are going to be packing up their U-Haul trailers and moving. And that raises an interesting question. Should you move to another city or even another country for a job? And if so, how do you do it? To answer those questions, we're joined by Alexandra Levitt. She's a business and workplace author, speaker, and consultant. Alexandra, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, David.
So it's not new, the idea that people would actually have to move from one place to another for a gig, but it's not easy. And in today's high-tech economy, you almost have to question whether it's even necessary.
Yes, you're absolutely right. I think the number one consideration people should be thinking about is, here's the question. If the job didn't exist, is the area in question someplace you would ever want to go? And what you really want to be thinking about is what your regular daily life would be like in this new location. So does it have a pace of life? Does it have amenities that appeal to you? What about the people, the culture, the weather? What about the traffic? Something to consider. A job is only one aspect of your life. And even if you love it, even if it's work you enjoy, that's not quite enough to overcome the distress of being in a location that isn't a good fit for you. So I would say that's the number one consideration when deciding whether or not you should relocate.
Seems like age is a factor, too. Earlier on in my working life, when I had fewer ties, no kids, things like that, the idea of moving to another place was a grand adventure. Then you become a little settled in life, and moving becomes a logistical nightmare.
That's absolutely correct. Relocations are definitely easiest when you're at a more flexible stage. But once you have that family, you have to think about what your spouse is going to do in that new city. Will he or she be able to get a good job? Is the area someplace you could envision raising your kids? Does it have good schools? Does it have safe play areas? And also extended family, we're seeing a move toward people wanting to be around grandparents and around aunts and uncles and cousins. And if your move is going to involve leaving those people, that's something to think about as well, because you'll have to build in a whole new source of social support.
We got a lot of listener feedback on this topic when we asked for stories. And we heard from one fellow, a guy named Gene, who talked about how he moved from L.A. to Atlanta for a job, hoped to maintain a long-distance relationship with his girlfriend. Things didn't quite work out in Atlanta, ends up moving back to L.A., and it sort of raises the question, is it worth taking a job that you're not 100% wedded to from the get-go? Do you really go just for something that might work or might not?
Well, I would advise that you would not do that. If he were considering making a similar move in the future, perhaps he would make a different decision. Of course, moving for a relationship is always risky, but I think moving for a job can be risky if you don't think about the fact that your organization is not going to offer permanent employment, probably. Most organizations are at will. And you want to really be able to find out whether or not that organization offers strong personal and professional development, the probability of advancement. If things don't work out with that individual job, will you be able to get and secure gainful employment at another job in the same area? Even if you think you're going to love that company, if you put your eggs all in one basket, it's going to be difficult if things don't work out in that geographic area. So you want to be sure you have options. And one of the good things that he did is he moved from one major metropolitan area to another. So he moved from LA to Atlanta, which at least those are both major cities. I would definitely not advise moving for a relationship to a rural or a declining area, for example, where you're really not going to have opportunities should that one not work out.
The economy's improving. The unemployment rate nationwide is now below 6% for the first time in a while. And yet it seems as though employers still have the advantage. So if you are working or if you are relocating, can you expect in this economy for your new employer to cover the nut of moving you? Or is this something that you're going to fund on your own?
I think in most cases, that, of course, depends on your level and the organization. But I see more and more organizations not paying relocation costs. And when we talk about relocation costs, we're talking about things like the moving company, having temporary housing, storage, airfare, things like that. I think the more important consideration when it comes to money is whether or not you can actually afford to live in the new city. You really want to be trying to think about whether your proposed salary and all of the benefits whether that will be enough to cover the cost of living in the new city. For example, I'm sure $75,000 a year goes a lot further in Atlanta, Georgia, than it does in Los Angeles. So that's something to think about. And ideally, you should be able to pay your monthly expenses and set aside some money for retirement. I think people think it's okay still to live paycheck to paycheck, but really that's not an ideal scenario and certainly not one you want to think about sustaining for the long term.
You know, you're describing a lot of risk, and I would imagine that a lot of people, they listen to this conversation, they think, you know what, I don't want to expose myself or my family to that level of risk.
It's definitely something to think about. You really have to be sure that the job is a wonderful opportunity that will never come about again, that it's too good to pass up, and that really the environment in the new city or even the new country will be something that you can make a go of it. And I think that with the risk also comes a sense of adventure. And I think that appeals to some people. They feel like change will be exciting and they'll enter a new phase of life. And there's something to be said for that, too.
Yes, indeed. Alexandra Levitt is a business and workplace author, speaker, and consultant. Alexandra, thank you very much.
Thanks, David.
Next week, we're saying I do.
I'm getting married in the morning. Ding dong, the bells are gonna chime. We'll have a whopper, pull out the stopper, get me to the church on time.
We're talking about unions of the romantic sort and the money that swirls around them. And we want to hear what you have to say. What are you spending on your wedding? How much are you spending to be a part of someone else's? Let us know by visiting our website, marketplaceweekend.org, and clicking on Go. You can also tweet us at MarketplaceWKND. And of course, there's always Facebook. Visit Marketplace's page. You can chat us up there. Migrating to the United States in search of a more prosperous life, that's a dream held by many. Veronica Ufart's no exception. When she first got here, her relatives in Nigeria, they sent money to the States to help out. These days, however, she supports around four families back home in Nigeria, along with her own family and extended family.
My name is Veronica Ufart. I'm in Nashville, Tennessee. Right here at my house with my three daughters.
Emmy is 25.
Hello.
Grace is 23.
Hello.
Anna is 17.
Hi.
I've been here over 28 years. The economy in Nigeria is kind of a little bit different from here. In the 70s, when my husband came here, the Nigerian money was had more value to the dollar because his dad used to send money for him here and he went to school with that. But now it's the other way around. The American dollar has more value than the Nigerian, we call it Naira right now. Like in 2014, Nigeria's economy became the largest in Africa. It was worth more than $5 billion. But even though we have all this money that I just told you about, the $5 billion and all that, but the common people doesn't see the money. It's like the rich get richer and the poor gets poorer. That's how it is. So it's really bad. So we send money home, like to our brothers or cousins, and we help them out because things are so difficult. Cost of living is very high, and people are going through a lot of hard times because of that. Things are not going well, so they cannot afford to take care of themselves. So that's how bad it is. That's why we have to send money back home to help them out. Sometimes it gets a little difficult, but we have to do it. We have to do without. That's what I'm trying to say, to make sure that they get, you know, at least have something to eat.
As well as taking care of families in Nigeria, Emmy, Veronica's oldest daughter, also feels taken care of by her mother.
She gives a lot to the extended family, but she gave so much to us. Like, I feel like she just sacrificed so much. I remember when she was working like 2 or 3 jobs just to make sure that we were okay.
Supporting families comes at a cost.
We don't save money like we're supposed to save money because we have our extended families to take care of. We don't do what we're supposed, you know, what we would like to do for our daughters or our children, to give them what they really needed, because we have to help our other families back home.
Let's end things today with a splash. So far on the show, we've been talking about human migration. But we're not the only ones on the go. Whales migrate all year round, and a whole ecotourism industry migrates with them. Many of us already know about prime whale-watching spots in Washington State, California, Mexico, Cape Cod. But other places, like Quebec or Ireland, they're also focusing on efforts to boost their whale-watching industries and promote ecotourism. Rashid Sumaila is a bioeconomist at the University of British Columbia. He studies whales and the businesses they inspire.
If you look at commercial fishing and ecotourism, marine ecotourism, there is a huge growth in the latter. Whale watching is part of this. It's a significant part of this. About $500 million of whale watching around the world a year, and supporting thousands of people in terms of jobs. So this is important, and it is growing. We're seeing growth of up to about 40%, actually, in parts of the world.
Off of the West Coast where I live, whale watching is a big deal. But I've gone out whale watching before, and it's also a roll of the dice, because sometimes the whales just don't want to cooperate.
Yeah, indeed, indeed. And you've hit on two important things here. Number one, for these businesses, for the tourism part, to thrive, we need to have healthy whale populations. So that is crucial. Number two, we need to understand the seasonal migration patterns of the whale. So if you go out here in the Vancouver area, if you don't go out between, say, March and October, the chances of you seeing whales is almost nil, because that's not when they migrate. So you need to know the migration pattern and the times, and the industry actually tries to do this, because otherwise their businesses will just not work. You have to have the whales, and you have to know how they migrate so that your business has to follow this. Between March and October, we have thousands of whales migrating close to Vancouver, and that is what the industry actually depends on.
I imagine that climate change is going to have profound effects on whale watching, because as water temperatures change, migration patterns will change.
Absolutely. And we see that as the ocean warms, as the surface temperature increases, animals move. Those that can move will move, and those that cannot will perish. You know, they are not like people. When it's too hot, you put on your air conditioner. When it's too cold, you put on the heater. They don't have that. They either move or they perish. And yes, we're seeing that the economics of whale watching and the economics of fisheries in general is going to be impacted significantly by climate change. There's going to be impacts, and there's a lot of research we are doing to try to help us really map out how we can deal with this, both for our businesses and for the animals themselves. How do we protect them?
So intriguingly then, as the whales move further north to get cooler water, this is potentially a boon for, say, Alaska, which now can beef up its whale-watching industry.
Yes, I mean, yes, there is a time dimension here that we shouldn't forget. So in the interim, as they move away from BC towards Alaska, they can start looking at this and building businesses and trying to benefit from that. But remember, that is not going to stop if we don't do something to really put the brakes on climate change. Because what happens is get warmer and they go further. Where do they end up, right? So there is a limit to even Alaska benefiting from this, if you think in terms of time, if we don't start acting.
And extending our migratory theme here, as the whales migrate, presumably the tourists will migrate to follow them so that they can have the whale-watching experience. That will have a beneficial effect on local economies, I gather, around the world.
Oh, yeah. As they move, places that didn't have these opportunities will see them, right? There will be losers and winners, and we don't know exactly who these will be. The patterns are beginning to show up. We're trying to understand this and trying to protect us, the businesses, the people, and the animals as these changes come.
As the whale migrations change, that represents an opportunity for new locations such as Quebec, Ireland, which are investing in their whale-watching industries. Are we seeing a big boost to the local economy as a result of this? And does the money that comes out of this kind of thing go back into conservation efforts?
There is a boost for areas that are seeing more whales because people follow the whales. The tourists want to see whales, and so that happens. Now, whether these benefits are getting back into conservation, at the moment, it doesn't seem so. And that is a good point because we need the conservation to protect these animals so that we can continue to benefit from them. One thing that I should add here is some of the whale-watching companies actually have a money-back guarantee. So when they take you out and you don't see a whale, they give you back your money. This, to me, shows how important it is that we conserve these populations. You know, without them, the businesses will not thrive. If you keep giving money back, very soon your business is going to go bust. So, yes, conservation efforts are crucial. So, please, anyone listening to this, whatever you can do to help us find a way to start reducing CO2 emissions, greenhouse emissions, to that would be a great contribution to our survival into the future.
Rashid Sumaila is director of the Fisheries Economics Research Unit at the University of British Columbia Fisheries Center. Rashid, thank you very much.
Thank you so very much. Thanks.
And that's our show for this week. Lizzie will be back next week, and we'll be talking about unions. Not the labor kind, the romantic kind. Weddings, elopements, that kind of thing. How much of your money has gone down the wedding hole? Did you have to shell out a lot to go to a friend's wedding? How do you budget for it? Tell us your stories of matrimony and money by visiting MarketplaceWeekend.org. Reach out on Marketplace's Facebook page, or of course, you can tweet us. We're at MarketplaceWKND. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Jenny Ament and Eliza Mills. Dan Samatovich is our senior producer. Bill Lance is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm David Lazarus, and until next time, I'll see you in the business section. This is APM.